The Production Expert Podcast is brought to you with the kind support of Arturia, Avid, Source Elements, and RSBE Audio Solutions.
Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast. I'm Julian Rogers. And in this week's edition, I'm joined by Ashaya and Steve DeMott. We're going to be discussing the importance and power of saying no in a music production environment. I don't know why I had to say that in a dramatic way. I just felt like I should. Very kind of brief. If you haven't seen an article that we published, written by William Whitman, on precisely this, we basically saw that and went, hey, that's a good idea. So we thought we'd do a podcast about it. But it is kind of like, you know, in these enlightened times of positivity and everyone having a voice and stuff, William sort of was pretty much saying, yeah, but sometimes you should say, no, it's a stupid idea. Let's carry on as we were.
Mm.
And yeah, that's it in a nutshell. So that was the Production Expert Podcast. Join us next week. I don't know. I mean, Ashaya, you liked this, didn't you? Go on, what did you think?
I do like it. I mean, I'd like to break it down into, you know, all the processes. So songwriting, recording, you know, sound design as well, all those things, because sometimes we can get decision fatigue. Right. So I think, why don't we start with the songwriting process and how we see saying no could actually help save time and just help with the creative process in general. Steve, do you have any examples? Oh. Straight over to you, Steve.
So in songwriting, okay.
Yeah.
Well, especially when you're collaborating, it comes down to what's the goal, right? If you're writing a song about whatever it is you're writing a song about. Not every idea gets you to your proposed storyline, right?
Mm.
So you have to be able to say, no, that's a dead end. No, that's not going to bring us anywhere. And sometimes, you know, I think we all know, all of us writers know that sometimes you pick a line because it fits the rhyme and line stress. But you're like, I'll replace that later because that's not going to work.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I don't know if you've ever been in a Nashville writing session.
I haven't, no.
No.
That's interesting, though.
You are not allowed to say no.
So you have to agree with everyone's ideas?
No, you don't. But
right.
You can't say no.
And oh, interesting.
It's kind of interesting because the theory behind it is that my crappy idea is going to spur a slightly less crappy idea from you and then a slightly even less crappy idea and then finally the good idea from somebody. And it's sort of the journey of it. But I found that, I mean, not being a Nashville guy myself and being up here in the more uptight Northeast, I find that a bit tiring at times because sometimes you know something's just not going to work, and you have to be like, no, that's not it.
And it's important to be comfortable with the people that you're collaborating with, and sort of not feel offended if someone says, "Nah, that's not a good idea. Let's go with something else." You know,
you have to have that trust, right? You have to be able to trust them to know that they're not just saying it because they just want to be difficult. They're saying it because it's truly what they feel is best for the project, and everyone benefits.
Now, I was just thinking, I mean, songwriting, that's kind of like the delicate end of the situation, if you like, just because, you know, I can absolutely see the downside of, like, don't suggest anything because you'll get slapped down. And absolutely, you know, hearing voices. But, I mean, I think possibly, I've certainly been guilty of this in the past when I've been contributing to writing. I'm not really a writer, but I've helped with the writing process on lots of occasions. And usually it's not about the idea, it's about whether or not an idea is needed. And isn't that really
yes.
what we're talking about?
Exactly.
Like, it's not about, hey, you know, hey, I mean, very often I'm the person who might be going, hey, we could this, that, da da da, and it'll be something that takes it possibly in a different direction, or could be something as simple as kind of like, you know, we could substitute this chord change for that chord, and then that could. But I mean, particularly if we're not at a stage where that stuff's really happening. And this is
right.
something I know I've been guilty of in the past, of like, no, the song's written. That's not what we're doing now. And it's like, oh, okay, all right. Isn't what we really need? I mean, this is about hierarchy, isn't it? And certainly whose place is it? Because I mean, certainly I know I've kept stum about far more ideas than I've contributed, just because it's been a case of like, that's not really why I'm here.
Well, exactly. And if someone's more qualified than you at a certain thing, it's probably best just to leave them to make the decisions about that certain thing.
Or if it's my ball and you're not playing. I mean, it's kind of like, it depends who you are and why you're there. But
well, yeah, and it depends on, somebody has to have, well, let's bring this to, like, for instance, a recording session where you've taken the song's ready, and you're trying to get a version of it down. Somebody has to be responsible for the vision.
This feels like a conversation we might have had on the podcast before about, well, what would you call someone who had that particular job then, Steve?
Well, and that's where this gets tricky, right? Because I would call it a producer, but that's not necessarily the current definition of that word.
Well, there is that, I suppose.
But someone does have to step up to the plate and say, okay, I'm in charge.
But somebody has to be in charge of the vision.
If somebody doesn't somebody have to either be elected or that task is delegated to keep one vision happening? But this is
but
the
isn't
opposite
the problem
of what you're
that
discussing.
Most of the time that doesn't happen.
I think it is.
They walk in and you know a band seems to think, oh, it's going to be very democratic, and that's when fights start. That's when people start throwing things at each other. You know, you've seen that happen, and it's because somebody didn't say, okay. Whether it's, hey, I wrote this one, so I'm going to have the final say, or if it's, you know, hey, we've designated this third-party person as our producer, and they're going to have final say because we trust their taste.
Because they're none of us who are in a band together and hate each other, presumably. But anyway,
Yeah, exactly. and I think that's part of it. I'm trying to remember when it was. A while back, I wrote an article where I called... the premise was, you know, the journey's a lot quicker when you know the destination. Saying that, you know, if you just go in trying to find, hey, I just want this to be good, there are thousands of good. Which good do you want? You know, and that's where the power of no comes in, right? You have to know which ones are the right ones.
It's funny because it sounds it's quite a powerful word, no. But actually, what it's saying is it's should we continue to go where we were going?
Well, think about it in terms of for those of us who remember the days of tape, when you had 24 tracks, or if you were lucky, they had two 24 track decks linked together. You had a finite number of tracks to use. And you knew that we need to, you know, there are certain things that just had to happen. Drums are going to take so many tracks regardless. You know, we're going to need vocals, background vocals. We're going to want to double those guitars. You didn't have a lot of extra, you know, tracks, extra resources to just say, hey, let's keep that and hold on to it. Where I think that became more of a thing with Dawes. You can have 50 versions of your guitar solo. And then at some point, you need to go back and listen to all of those and decide, you know, what you like. And then you're going to end up with, like, you know, the solo from Jump.
Or say that you listen to all of them and actually
or
choose
say
the same.
And not
listen to
one,
them. Exactly.
Which is more likely when you have 50 or 60 of them down.
Yeah.
Where it's so much easier just to say, no, that wasn't it. You want to save it? No, just erase it. I don't even care.
Ever wondered what it's like to mix an entire album for Kanye? Or layering vocals for Chris Brown? Join your hosts, Cash and G, every fortnight as we sit down with some of your favorite artists, producers, and engineers to talk everything music. Brought to you by Avid Pro Tools.
That sounds great.
But also, if it's just good enough, you know, so, you know, sometimes this is tied to perfectionism and procrastination and all those things. But sometimes if a take is good, do we really need to do it again to try and make it perfect? That's right. One thing. Another thing as well is committing in your DAW. So if you've got a sound that you like and you've tweaked it and it sounds pretty good and you're happy, if you bounce it in place, then you can't keep tweaking it.
Right.
You know, and I think that's an important thing because sometimes we can get obsessed with tweaking things constantly and it just leads us nowhere and it's just a complete time waster as well.
Right. You can go right down that rabbit hole with, you know, hey, is it better with 3 dB boost or 4 dB?
Exactly.
3 or 4. Back. Hey, what do you think? And you go back and forth.
I know, exactly.
And an hour later, you haven't made a decision.
I've got quite a nice illustration of this, actually, of kind of like where this stuff can really work. And I mean, very often this stuff's about about personalities and managing people and kind of making sure that people feel heard, even if they're actually being ignored. It's kind of, you know, there's a lot of psychology that comes into this stuff. I don't really mean that, but you kind of know what I mean.
Do you know what? I'm thinking of the mixer that pretends he's or she is sort of putting up the vocal by a couple of dB, but isn't actually doing anything.
Just the DFA. I mean, anyone who's, absolutely. We're very familiar with that. But I'm reminded of the fact that, I mean, sort of like quite, a, I mean, I don't know, more than 10 years ago, I was in a band with Luke off the blog. It was an extremely successful setup because hierarchy was in place. Just because what it was that Luke writes material, very good actually, and he'd recorded a load of stuff, doing everything himself. He can play multiple instruments, and he had offers for some live work, and he had no band. And a few friends got together and said, yeah, we'll be in your band, we'll play your stuff. And it was really nice just because the definitive version already existed of all of these songs. And what we did was we just learnt them and played them. And there wasn't any debate about, hey, what about, or whatever, just because the parameters for the project were extremely clear. Mm. It worked very nicely. Also, anyone who's ever seen me and Luke in a social situation, I talk over him appallingly. I mean, I'm the
one. That's surprising. Just,
absolutely. And it's the idea of me kind of going, yeah, whatever you say, boss, is you know, isn't something that you might naturally associate with me if you've seen that kind of, you know. But it works perfectly because it was an example of like, I know why I'm here, you know why I'm here, let's just do that and get on with it. And it worked extremely well. Now, that's only one way of doing it, I know. But it is a nice example that illustrates this point that it's, you know, you can talk about lots of other stuff, but is that what you're actually doing?
Right.
Is that exactly.
There are times where it's just, you're just there to play your part and, you know, as they say in Broadway, you know, just play the ink.
And I have to say that was really, really liberating. I really enjoyed that project just because all of the stuff that I could do wasn't any of my business, so I didn't do it. So I just enjoyed being a bass player in a band, and it was like brilliant.
It takes the pressure off, doesn't it?
Well, it's just kind of like, you know, something's not right about the mix. It's like, well, don't talk to me. I'm the bass player, you know. So yeah, no, that was.
But then the flip side of this, though, is let's go back to the studio situation. Is sometimes somebody has a great idea,
right?
And I think what William was trying to get at is knowing when it's a great idea or knowing when it's a bad idea. And he used the wah-wah pedal in the chorus example. Yeah. And, you know, there are some guitarists and, you know, you say, hey, oh, try it, because sometimes they come up with brilliant stuff. And then there are the guys that are like, yeah, but he wants to put a wah-wah on everything. So just say no and save mm-hmm. ourselves an hour. And, you know, so you have to kind of know the players. You have to kind of know who's involved and what their personality
is. And sometimes you know an idea is not the right one without having to hear it. It's,
yeah,
it's very
I mean,
true.
You know. Is a wah-wah in the chorus ever the right idea? I don't know. So that could be an easy decision.
Well, it strikes me that we haven't spoken very much about the kind of the mix stage. And this is possibly one where, I mean, certainly in my experience, possibly because of what I've spent quite a bit of time doing, you get quite a lot of ideas suggested, not all of which you necessarily want to explore. I don't know, Steve, have you got any thoughts, anything come to mind when it comes to that end of the project?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing you have to remember as the mixer is that your job is to, you know, take... Now, let me back up a half a second here. So there are two scenarios here. One is that you were involved from the start and you were the recording engineer. So you know what the band was going for, or the artist, if it, you know, was going for. You know what they've been trying to get throughout these days of recording. And then in that respect, it's a lot easier, right? Because you go in, you sit down to mix, and you already kind of know where you're trying to end up.
Mm.
Flipping the coin, if you're just getting the files from somebody who recorded it, and they're, you know, 4,000 miles away... Now you have a little bit of a different situation. They're probably going to send you a rough and maybe some tracks that they're shooting for. And usually then they say, yeah, but not like that. And you know the drill, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so that makes it a lot harder because now you have a lot of options in front of you. In my experience, the best options are the ones that play into what's going on in the recording. And when you try to like pull too far away, like if you have, say, let's say it's, you know, straight ahead rock band and they recorded, and they say they even recorded live in the studio. So, I mean, we're talking, you know, there's energy, it's a little raw. You're not going to go and time align everything. You're not going to tune those vocals to within an inch of their life. You know, that kind of stuff would just be wrong for the track.
Mm.
The same way you wouldn't take a pop song and not tune the vocals or add big distorted guitars at the, you know, to bring in a chorus. I mean, it really depends on, you know, what you're kind of tasked with at that moment, yeah. The genre, the feel of the song, where it's going, what the lyrics are.
Would you say having just one reference or two references maximum is a good idea? Just, you know, say to the artist, can you give me a reference of the track that you like and then work to achieve that?
That's often helpful, as long as they don't turn around and say, yeah, I like this, but not that way. You know, then you have to infer what they liked about it, whether it was a specific sound in there. But yeah, reference always does help.
Some of the best advice I've seen about references was from Don Morley. It was a piece he wrote some time ago. I forget precisely when. And he made a really good point of multiple references are a good thing. You know, a decent amount of communication before a mix begins is helpful. But it also has to be specific. And if a reference is submitted as a kind of, hey, I like this track, it's really good if that person also tells you what it is that they like about that track. He gave an example of kind of like it was like the snare sound they liked. It wasn't the delay on the vocal or whatever it may have been. Do you see what I mean?
But, right.
Absolutely.
But yeah, some specific and non-contradictory advice before.
Yeah, well,
begins.
We forget that, you know, oftentimes, and I know I'm kind of known to do this at times too, is you forget that people don't know what you are thinking when you are telling them something like, hey, I like this track. When you, like as what Dom pointed out, if you can be a lot more specific, I love the drums in this track, or I really love the vocal sound in this track. You know, it really helps a mixer kind of nail what you're after in fewer rounds of revisions.
Something that I think probably, I mean, I know I've been around this before, which is not getting distracted by new or unanticipated possibilities. Just because certainly I know I've seen people, I mean, literally get distracted by something that's in the studio and going, we could use that. And they find out what it is, and it's a cool thing. And it's like,
yeah,
great, this has nothing whatsoever to do with the project. And it makes me think of some really bad examples of kind of records that I know where I just think, oh, that had just arrived, hadn't it? And you had to play with it. And, you know,
I mean, it goes into that gear acquisition syndrome thing that we speak about all the time.
The new and the shiny. Yeah, absolutely. And this is kind of the thing about, you know, whenever you've got something that's kind of, you know, radically different from something that you've used before, then try it out and explore it, but don't necessarily do it when other people are listening.
Yeah.
Achoria has a wide selection of software effects, including 3 compressors, 3 filters, 3 preamps, and 3 delays you'll actually use. The latest release, 3 delays you'll actually use, includes Delay Tape 201, Delay Memory Brigade, and the unique and experimental Delay Eternity. A bundle of selected effects, called the AudioFuse Creative Suite, is included with all AudioFuse audio interfaces. Visit Achoria.com to find out more on the effects you'll actually use.
I know we, as mixers and producers, we try to please the client, and if they're paying, you know, if it's their song, then we need them to be happy. But there comes a point where you have to trust your own expertise, and if you are really happy with the mix and the client's saying, oh, I don't like this, can you change this? You do have to find the courage to say, if you're happy with it, no, I'm not going to do any more tweaks because I think this is the correct way, right?
I mean, the thing really, I mean, if we're talking at the mix stage, I mean, we all know that thing about, oh, turn me up. And that needs to be dismissed out of hand.
Yes.
Just called out for what it is about, I'll do you a mix with you turned up if you want, but it's what I think,
but
you know.
It's because, not the final mix, yeah.
Because we've all heard that, and it's perfectly natural, and, you know, kind of like, yeah, any feedback in the bass player says, oh, the bass could go up a bit. And I'm thinking, could it now?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's kind of, you know, like I say, not that surprising or unusual or important. But yeah, I mean, I think certainly the thing that I'm more familiar with in this situation than anything else really is if you've got something which has existed in demo form for any amount of time, and then people come back and they just want it to sound like the demo.
Demoitis, that's the same.
We've talked about this before, and it can be very difficult to. I mean, sometimes it's because the demo is really good, in which case, great. But if it's just because it's familiar, that's not the same thing. And like, yeah, it's familiar to you, but it's never going to be familiar to anybody else ever. So, you know.
Because it's comfortable. It's like, this is how I've heard it for the past 6 months. And yeah, that could be a danger for an artist. And that's where a good producer has to step in. And I think I've seen more failed songs because they failed to assign a producer to stop them from doing things detrimental to their mix. But yeah, but to get back to the question about the mix, it's a slippery slope to get too comfortable saying no in those situations. But there are times you need to say, hey, I don't think that's the right thing.
It's a delicate balance, isn't it?
It is a delicate balance. And sometimes what you need to do is just, you know, give them a quick version of like, let me take 30 seconds of the song. I'll bounce that out for you with that. And just take a listen and see if you hear what I think we're going to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, you have to just, you have to appease a little bit to keep the relationship in a good place, because if they trust you and if you approach those things in a way where you're sensitive to the fact that they are asking for a creative decision to be followed through, they will begin, you know, over time to trust you if time and time again your advice turns out to be right.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what's great about building a relationship with somebody, is at a certain point, they just trust you. Like, I have one artist I work with, he sends me a demo, and then next time I call him, I'm like, hey, we're ready for the studio. I've got all your tracks recorded. And he doesn't even blink an eye.
Yeah.
The trust is there over all the years. But
it takes a while.
It takes a while. And then there are, you know, the new clients you work with who are very guarded because they're like, this is my thing. I don't want anyone messing with it. And that's usually a bad place to be too as an artist, because now you've closed off anyone who has a different idea than you. And let's be honest, having the ability to accept input from other people is a really important way to improve.
That's a really good point. Yeah, yeah.
I completely agree. I've had a situation with an artist I've worked with for 2 years now, I believe. But at the beginning, she was quite guarded and she sort of was concerned, oh, are you going to do this? Are you sure you know what you're doing? Are you going to do this right? I'm worried. You know, she's had maybe bad experiences in the past. And obviously over time, now she asks less questions. She sort of just lets me get on with it. So yeah, I completely agree that it does take time, and to build trust, you need to, at least at first, you know, say, okay, well, we'll try it your way. What do you think? Now, here's my idea. What do you think? And then they sort of begin to trust you. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a really important point here about being able to draw a distinction between the idea and whose the idea was, just because that can get quite counterproductive in situations where people are either resistant to input from other people because they think it will dilute the themness of the project.
Right.
This is kind of something.
Well, that reminds me of completely not music, but it reminds me of Apple in the 90s. Apple had a extreme not created here culture. And if it wasn't in-house, they didn't want to deal with it. And we all know what happened towards the end of the 90s for Apple. They almost folded. And it was when they started bringing in outside technologies. I mean, that's where we got Logic. That's where we got Final Cut Pro. Those were all outside projects that they bought and, you know, recreated in-house. But, you know, it's an example in the tech world, but it's an example of what happens when you close off to anything else happening outside.
People outside of that process don't care whose idea it was. They just like good stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And if you have the common cause that you work towards, which is we want a great product and we're going to leave our egos aside to get this good product, you know, and try to identify what are the good decisions, what are the good ideas, despite whether it's your idea or not, really.
And I said we should have a slightly shorter plate reverb on this, and that deserves a co-write credit. So.
Of course.
I need 3 points for that, right?
Exactly. No, we're joking, but there is, of course, that side to things. But, you know, I mean, I can't help thinking that a lot of the time people have... having those kind of disagreements are probably arguing over, you know, however much percent of nothing. So it's kind of like, you know.
And maybe that's, you know, another part of this is that, you know, the other part of being able to accept other people's opinions is to have an agreement about that going in. I think it was very interesting. Dave Grohl, who after leaving Nirvana and started the Foo Fighters, he had a very democratic view of ownership of stuff after seeing what happened within Nirvana. And I only recently learned about that in some interview. And I thought that was really smart. He said, you know, more fighting happened because who owns what percent of this song? And that's it. Everyone is on the... You know, everyone gets a percentage, equal percentage, and that's all there is to it. We're all
we can all think of bands where fights over royalties were as significant as any other part of their career, and it's like this is really not what's interesting about bands and music. So
yeah.
I mean, how many bands broke up over, you know, a fight over a percentage of a song?
And would you say it's important for that to be signed and agreed upon before going into the session?
You know, I think that just helps everything. And that helps people feel like I'm not giving up. You know, like if I'm the songwriter and I've already said, hey, we're all going to get percentage on this, now I don't feel like someone's trying to steal something.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
And if you're feeling like that from your own band, maybe you need to rethink who's in your band, but that's your own decision.
Yeah, I honestly think that's the best way of working.
I do too. I think just keep it democratic. I mean, in the end... you know, everyone can get credit in some manner, and that doesn't diminish, you know, a writer's contribution to an album, or if, you know, they're bringing two or three songs that they wrote all by themselves. There are still ways to give everybody credit and keep everybody happy and allow for that exchange of ideas, so you don't necessarily throw away somebody's idea because you're afraid they're going to want a percentage.
Yeah.
And say no to a great idea.
And if you're really concerned about that, then just kind of write something that's going to get picked up in a film or something, because otherwise you're just kind of worrying about very little. So,
yes, yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, you're worried about that Spotify
payout, Spotify
right?
Millions are going
to
come.
Oh, my goodness. Right. Well, we certainly want to be arguing
that's
over those.
That's a whole nother podcast.
Yes, it is.
The Production Expert Podcast is made possible using Source Connect Now from Source Elements, the free way to record high-quality audio over the internet. Need to record an interview or a podcast like this one remotely? With Source Connect Now, you can. Using a Chrome browser, you'll get ISDN-equivalent quality audio without the need to install any additional software. Register for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
So I think we're kind of one mind on this, really, that kind of like saying no can be a good thing, which isn't the same thing as saying no is necessarily a good thing, because obviously open-mindedness and collaboration and stuff are all good things. But if you want to make progress on a project, then sometimes saying yeah is possibly a massive time saver and a bit of a hack. So that's my take.
I mean, even when you're alone, saying no is a good thing. I mean, if you're writing by yourself, knowing when you're, it's like, that's not going to work, and just throwing it away.
To avoid decision fatigue as well.
Exactly, because if you save every idea that you think might be good later, you're never going to progress.
Because my solo project has broken up. Yeah, I've had this massive falling out with myself.
And yeah, exactly.
I can see how that would happen.
Okay.
But even things just before we move on to Find of the Week, things like sound design as well. I know some people that feel like they're cheating if they don't design their own kick drum and things like that. But I just feel like that's a massive time waster when you could get a sample. No one would notice if you're using a sample. And I just think it would sound better anyway, because the amount of time that you spend sort of designing a kick drum, compressing it, layering it, you could end up just using a sample as well. So just small little things, small decisions can really, really help.
There's a counter that I've got to that, though, which is just that I am in favour of using things that you've made yourself, because it can be faster, because that way you don't disappear down a rabbit hole of checking out everything everyone else in the world has ever made, trying to find the definitive right one.
There is that as well.
I've certainly done that with some convolution impulses I've taken in the past, which I quite like. And because I made them, I'm going, I'm going to go with that. And I only stopped doing that when I stopped using convolution, which, you know, Liquid Sonic's kind of killed that for me, to be honest. But there we are.
I mean, that's another thing, isn't it? Saving, you know, presets and saving things that you can sort of use again down the line instead of redoing everything and auditioning sounds as well. Just things like this.
Why reinvent the wheel every time you want to do something? It doesn't make sense.
Mm, absolutely.
But unfortunately, it seems to be a little bit of the approach for a lot of people is to reinvent the wheel every time they want to do something. And you know, if you have some free time, that's the time to go through all the samples and find like the five or six that you really like, put them in a folder and be like, these are the ones I pick from for, you know, the next several projects, and save yourself time, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
A little pre-production always helps. And in the case of that kind of writing, pre-production could just be having your samples set and ready to go. You know, you have these dozen samples you really like and boom.
Exactly. And templates and things like that. And using, you know, certain stock plugins as well that can sound perfectly good, or just having a handful of plugins that you know really well and you use all the time and not have to sift through, you know, hundreds of different plugins to experiment with them as well.
And you don't have to throw extra plugins on because you don't feel like you're doing something. You know what I mean?
Like
sometimes people add a plugin because like, that can't be good. I need to add more.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'm helping somebody with their mixing, and I sent him a message and just said, hey, you know, you've got a great song here, but I think you're overcooking it. I was like, I want you to take everything off and just throw a channel strip on every channel and just mix it with that.
Yeah.
He's like, what? I was like, just mix it with that. You don't need more than that. You can get all great sounds with just that. And, you know, just trying to remind people that it's not about the plug, how many plugins you use. It's about the emotion of the track when you're
absolutely
done.
Yeah. And knowing your tools as well. That's an important one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm often surprised when somebody, you know, I have somebody in the studio and they look at my session and they're like, that's all you're using? Well, yeah, that's all I need. I don't need 10 plugins on this track. One's fine. You're like, but you got nothing on that. It's like, yeah, because it was recorded well. It's fine. Don't worry about it. You know, it's like everyone feels like you have to do stuff.
Oh, it's terrible. I was called in to redo a mix of a few mixes years ago, actually, of, I won't say his name, but he just stuck plugin after plugin and it was a terrible mess and I had to redo the whole thing. I just took everything off and started again. But very stressful indeed when that happens. Julian, do you have examples of where that's happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, just those handful of shortcuts in Pro Tools where you can just bypass everything. And they make a huge amount of difference. It's something that, I mean, I do wish it was built into, I don't know if this exists in any DAW, but I kind of wish it did, particularly in Pro Tools. It's just something you can set up so that it'll match levels, regardless running through the mixer in an intelligent way, just to encourage everybody, particularly people who don't balance up gains when they're setting stuff up. I mean, this is what I spend most of my time when I'm mixing doing, is if I put some compression on something or some EQ or something, then I'm tweaking the output levels to make sure that it's subjectively the same level so I can get meaningful ABs. This is it's something that I keep coming back to, of like, why doesn't this do this for me? Because I'm doing the same thing every time. If you could get something that did that intelligently and you know, well, across the whole mixer, so you could just go everything off, everything back on, and anyone could do it, no matter how they set their processes up. I think they'd quickly realise that more isn't necessarily better. And funnily enough, that's something I wrote today, which will be on the blog very soon.
Ooh,
about quality over quantity, which is a different thing. But there we go. It feels to me like we should leave it at where we were with kind of, I think, as I said a minute ago, we're pretty much of one mind that yes, good, don't overuse it, but no is a handy word in these situations.
Absolutely.
We should possibly move on to Find of the Week.
Let's, Steve, what's your Find of the Week?
So my Find of the Week is my wife, for Christmas, got me this Zoom H6 recorder. It's a little handheld field recorder. I do a lot of grabbing of nature sounds and sound effects and stuff like that. I have the huge library. I use it when I do post for either, you know, short films, indie films, or even features. And I've forever been using, like, you know, different kinds of things. And this is one that she saw me looking at it, and she knew I kind of wanted it, and it would simplify my life. And it does. It's a great little recorder for what it does. Records to a little SD card, and then I could just pop that into my Mac and pull the files off later. It has 4 preamps plus the little XY mic configuration that it comes with. And it's great. I even would consider using that if I were doing like a remote podcast or something. Just plug a couple mics into that, hit record, go. It's a great little device.
Very nice. And how heavy is it? I'm looking at it now. It looks quite sturdy.
It's well built. It definitely feels well built. It's solid, but not too heavy that you can't carry it, and it's comfortable.
They're a reasonable size. I don't know what this one's like, but the old H4s, the thing that used to make me quite wary of them was that if you drop them end down, you snap the capsules. These ones, I think they're kind of like shot-mounted or rubberized to some extent, are they? A bit more drop-proof?
Yeah, they seem to have. I'm wiggling them now.
And you can change the heads on them as well for other...
You can. Yeah. And the microphones are... The capsules are decent on this. But I've been using it with some KM-184s, and that's even better.
Yeah. Something I quite like with these, have I used that particular one? I think I have, actually. But for a very sort of quick and dirty recording of gigs, if you have one of those, and then you run 2 channels off the board combined with something in the room, you can get something that's passable for use with video and stuff.
You can. The drummer in my band has, I think it's the H4 of it, and that's what he does. He takes it off the board, and we get a board mix from that.
And on a small gig, you can't take a board mix because it's just kick drum and vocals, you know. But if you get the stuff that's in the room off the other 2 channels, you can get something will do.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen a couple of videos on that, actually. It looks interesting.
Yeah, it's a fun way of working.
Very cool.
So a fun little toy, and for once, my find of the week is not a compressor, so there we go.
Fantastic. Julian, what's your find of the week?
Oh, well, it has to be the PMC 6.2, they're not 6.2, 6-2, 6.2s anyway, but I've had those over Christmas. They went yesterday, and there's a big hole in my studio where they used to be, but they're lovely, and they're too expensive for me, and I couldn't afford to keep them I wasn't planning on anyway, but they're so good. They really
and you couldn't convince anyone to get them, so you could
I mean, I heard them before. I mean, there's a on test article up on the site, and in that I explained what it is that I like about them. But if you haven't heard a pair of PMCs, I mean, do, just because they're different. The transmission line thing, I mean, it's something I was sort of previously familiar with anyway. But it really does make a difference. They're unlike other speakers because of that. Mm. But they're just brilliant and sound amazing. And, you know, people who have really nice monitoring systems and can afford proper stuff, you know, a lot of them use these. There's only a handful of monitors that I've heard. I've heard a lot of nice monitors, and only a handful have stayed with me as being kind of like, oh, they were special. And, you know, like the bigger ATCs sound absolutely incredible. The Key 3s made my jaw drop when I first heard them because of the way they work and what they do. It really does work. And also these PMCs, you know, I mean, I've heard them before, and it was just kind of like, well, that's amazing. The Genelec, the ones as well, I'm going to call out of, like, those set up properly with GLM worked fantastically well. Some people would get a bit sniffy about those. I've never understood why. But these PMCs, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be buying anything like that anytime soon. But
if you've got the money.
I was saying to a friend on Facebook that I considered selling my car, then I remembered that it wouldn't even have paid for one of them. But if I put some more money in it, like, mono's cool, you know, I could maybe do that. But yeah, no, they're fantastic.
So tempting, but not possible.
That's not going to happen to me anytime soon. But, you know, but this is a thing that I sort of keep coming back to. And I mean, on a wider thing, really good quality monitoring is just better You know, it really is.
Oh,
you
yes.
can chop and change staying in the same part of the market and all you've got is different. But if you take a proper step up, it's like, yes, I can hear where the money goes. And this is what I keep coming back to of kind of the thing that, well, one of the many things that makes me reluctant to take the plunge into Atmos monitoring is that you're inevitably, compared to your stereo monitoring, unless you can properly fund it, which, you know, most people are going to, it's going to be a stretch to do it. You're going to be taking a step down in terms of quality of your monitoring, unless you can find a lot of money from somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, what would you rather have? Some fantastic stereo monitoring or some good Atmos monitoring, or maybe just okay Atmos? You know what I mean? It's like kind of, you know, if you multiply things up 10 times.
You have to trust your monitors, right?
Well, yeah, you know. I mean, of course, if you have to work it, if you have to do that kind of work, you've got to do it. I get that.
Right.
But people who are just kind of want to dip a toe into that stuff, you know, I'd rather stay with good stereo than to do kind of okay Atmos.
Yeah, because you're competing with some of the biggest studios with Atmos as well. You know, unless you can do it really properly, it's difficult.
Yeah, a bit of a money pit. Anyway, this was supposed to be a find of the week. Why am I talking about this for ages? But anyway, PMC 6.2, they're fantastic. Shay, what about you? What's yours?
Okay, so mine is Aberrant DSP. It's been around for a while. It's called Sketch Cassette 2. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a tape emulation plugin. So basically, I was mastering an album just before Christmas and they wanted to put it onto a cassette tape. So I wanted to use this as a reference. It's really cool. It's got a sort of a really fun looking GUI. Basically, looks like
I've just followed the link.
I'm looking at it now.
Yeah, can you see it? It's like a 90s teen kind of school book with all the doodles and stuff, which is it really gets you in the mood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's
nice.
Very cool.
And so they give you many different tape type references, and you can have tape type one, type two, and whether it's a cheap cassette tape or a value cassette tape, which is quite fun. And then there's a slider as well, so you can choose like the age of the tape as well, so whether it's new or more worn as well. And they've got some nice presets, and also it just sounds really nice on the master bus, or the saturation that it adds, and things like drums as well to kind of add that grit and that kind of lo-fi sound. So I'm going to use it a lot more, actually. It was kind of a discovery just before Christmas doing the mastering. But yeah, really, really cool. And it's okay. Only £30.
So, I mean, what I'm getting here is, I mean, Steve, we're both of a vintage who remember cassettes
yes.
from being kind of like, yeah, all you had. And no top end, okay.
Mm.
Loads of hiss. You can get used to that. The thing that used to do my head in about cassettes wasn't even flutter, actually. It was wow. It was that, you know, just old battered cassettes that were stretched and just kind of, and that kind of stuff was so hard to ignore. I think if I could have had a cassette player which definitely had no wow or flutter, I could probably have put up with the other stuff. And with this, you kind of have.
Yeah.
If you ever consider just like getting a cassette deck, because you could pick one up for pretty much nothing. I wouldn't, but you know, hey, if you like it.
Yeah, I mean, this is so simple. Obviously, it's a plug-in. But yeah, I make, for R&B, hip-hop, that sort of thing, when you want sort of lo-fi beats, it's very cool. And you can go crazy with it as well, which is really nice, kind of crunchy drum sounds, that sort of thing. So I like it, yeah. Very cool.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, looking at the interfaces, I recognize the tape they've drawn in there.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I was like, oh, I know that cassette. Yeah.
But dear, oh dear, yes, cassettes. There's something of a cultural watershed between the generations, I think, just because, yeah.
It was funny when Stranger Things came out and everyone was buying Walkman. And I kept saying, oh, what are they going to play on those?
Well, I mean, you can still get cassette tapes, but something that kept cassettes demand for cassettes going for years was Police interview machines.
Oh, really?
Right.
Because they were used for a really long time because there wasn't because they were inherently, you know, much more difficult to tamper with, you know.
Right.
I think they kind of stretched demand out for quite a while. But yeah, I mean, the thing that I remember about cassette Walkmans really was just the fact that, you know, that whole sensitivity to tape speed, and as the batteries started to wear out, which they did, you know, pretty much immediately, then, yeah, you know, your tape would start to slow down.
The pitch of everything would start to drop, yeah.
Wouldn't it have been really annoying having to rewind all the time?
But that's what some biros were for, and you'd sit there for ages spinning it. I mean, this is again one of those things that kind of like, do you really not remember this, of just sitting there trying to save the batteries on your cassette, yeah, Walkman by spinning it on a pencil?
Yes,
which takes a long time.
It really does.
So you're not nostalgic for those days, then?
No.
or when the Walkman would eat the tape, and then you'd spend, you know, 15 minutes trying to get it out without snapping.
No, car stereos was the one, because you couldn't get to it.
And yeah, that was terrible, because you just had to pull and pray, because it's like, yeah, I don't know if this is going to come out.
Captain wrapped it around the pinch roller, and he, come on, you guys. So, yeah, absolutely. But yeah, there we go. Anyway, yes, recollections may differ, I think is the phrase.
I think so.
But anyway, there we go. That was fun. Anyway, so thank you very much to Ashay. Thank you very much to Steve. That's all we've got time for this week. So we'll be back again next week with another edition of the Production Expert Podcast.